It's time for our How to Improve segment. This is our monthly check-in with the Metropolitan Planning Council. Talk about some of the issues facing us here in the Midwest, whether it's transportation, government efficiency, taxes, infrastructure. We have to put our minds together to come up with a plan for the short and the long term. So why not start right here on the download? That's the plan. That's what we've been doing with the Metropolitan Planning Council. And we continue tonight. We take on an issue that's way more complicated than infrastructure, but it's that the city of Chicago is definitely in need of improvement. That area is segregation. It's no secret that Chicago continues to be one of the most segregated cities in America. But what if it became clear that said segregation, keeping white and black populations apart, was costing money? Yep, what are the hidden costs to our society as taxpayers to the current setup? And would putting forth a plan for integration, would it increase efficiency? There's a conversation to have, and we're going to have it tonight. In studio with me, Marisa Navarro. She's a director at the Metropolitan Planning Council. Good to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Justin.
So let's talk about that. I'm fascinated. First of all, this is a two-year study you guys are embarking on. This is brand new. So talk about why the Metropolitan Planning Council has identified this as an area to study.
Sure. So over a year ago, my organization, Metropolitan Planning Council and Urban Institute, set out to try to answer a question, which is really, you know, is Chicago's segregated status quo cost neutral? And really, this came up for me in a series of meetings about some changes to affordable housing policy where, and lots of changes that I was suggesting were sort of met with, oh, that'll cost too much money.
Right.
And it slowly began to dawn on me, you know, I think we have this sort of underlying assumption that our status quo is cost neutral. And so anything we want to change will be cost prohibitive. And it then occurred to me, well, we don't really have a way to counter that. We don't have a good argument or a good set of data to really get at, well, is that really true of our status quo?
That's so interesting. It's true. Like status quo will, especially even if the status quo is expensive.
Right.
Changing it in any way is a way that people just don't want to get involved in.
That's right. And so, you know, we were really interested in saying, well, so if there is a cost, then what is the impact to everyone? Because I think to the degree we do talk about segregation, it tends to be focused on what are the negatives that accrue to low-income people of color, people living in concentrated mm-hmm. poverty. And we really leave out the negatives that may accrue to people living on the other end of the spectrum in concentrated wealth, which is the other end side of that coin, right?
Right,
and then, of course, also the dwindling number of people in between those two poles. So that was the impetus question. And then the second question, of course, is, well, if there is a cost, what do we do about it? What are the things we need to be doing? So we're kind of working in tandem on those two questions.
Okay. So, as we think about how to improve segregation, obviously the if you think about what's the opposite of segregation, it's integration. Obviously, the idea of taking neighborhoods or taking different regions of our city and being able to blend. But talk about that, because there's something to be said about Chicago being a city of neighborhoods, and ethnic enclaves are obviously a part of the city of neighborhoods. I would think that there would be some pushback to wanting to preserve the concept of, you know, historic black neighborhoods or historic German neighborhoods or what have you.
Sure.
As opposed to just, you know, making sure or some sort of social project where we all come together.
Sure. And that is an argument I've definitely heard a lot. And I would agree that ethnic enclaves can definitely be incredible places. And they've helped lots and lots of new Americans acclimate to life here and set up a whole economic structure and preserve culture and so on. But they're also not what I'm talking about when I'm talking about segregation. And that's for two reasons. Ethnic enclave experience is one that's very highly race dependent. And I think that's really important to remember. A couple years ago, there was a study out of Harvard that looked at Chicago neighborhoods and found that if a neighborhood is more than 40% African-American, it does not gentrify. The experience of African-Americans in middle-class neighborhoods is one that I've looked at. We looked at it at MPC and found that, you know, if you if you're living in a middle-class neighborhood and you're African-American,
right,
the neighborhoods that surround you tend to be low income. If you are living in a middle class neighborhood and you're white, the neighborhoods that surround you tend to be affluent, more affluent than
wow,
you are.
Interesting.
So the experience of living in this city and across this region is highly race dependent. And I think that's a very important thing to keep in mind when we talk about ethnic enclaves, because that experience varies so widely by race. it's not the same thing to compare an ethnic enclave to an area formed by state-sponsored segregation.
Right, right. You can't say that an area like Inglewood is the same as Lincoln Square in the way that Lincoln Square is a German neighborhood, so Inglewood is a black neighborhood. It doesn't work in terms of equality because they're not celebrating the same heritage, if that makes sense.
I think that's a fair way to put it.
Is that the way? I mean, the concept being that Inglewood is going to find itself with so much more socioeconomic problems, where Lincoln Square is just saying, hey, this is great. Germans settled here.
I mean, you know, the example I think of is my dad, who grew up in a Sicilian enclave in Detroit, right? And it was an incredibly, I mean, it was a very tight Sicilian neighborhood. There was no doubt that that was the feel and the vibe there, and it had a lot of positives. But they also had a fair amount of freedom, had they wanted to move across town to an area that was primarily Polish or German. Among other white ethnics, they had a lot of freedom to mix had they wanted to. And that freedom is not afforded historically to African Americans in the same way.
There's so much. Let's take a quick break. But there's so much to talk about here. 312-981-7200 about the concept of whether or not segregation is cost neutral. And that's really what we're talking about here as the Metropolitan Planning Council studies this. They're embarking on a 2-year study to really get to the nuts and bolts of what is the cost of segregation in a city like Chicago. Marisa Navarra is a director at the Metropolitan Planning Council. She's my guest. We'll take a break. Stay with us. It's our How to Improve segment. We've been doing this every month here on the download on 720 WGN for the whole summer with the Metropolitan Planning Council. Tonight, Marisa Navarra is in studio. She's a director at the Metropolitan Planning Council. We're taking on the tough issue of segregation. And segregation, obviously, it's a negative word when it comes to the city of Chicago, because we've seen segregation, and you'll see that this is a segregated city, mostly because of the resource issue. And we've had this, you know, Natalie Moore was on the program talking about the book Southside, and we talked about the concept that their resources are not allocated similarly in the city of Chicago. So affluent neighborhoods, middle-class neighborhoods are getting more money than some of the other areas, and it almost continues the cycle continues in the city when it comes to segregation, poverty, all the things that are associated with it. And you guys are setting out to try and look at this issue over a 2-year period to see if you can determine where segregation lies when it comes to costing money. So let's talk about that, because one of the things that always gets thrown out about segregation is people want to live with people that they look like or that are the same as them. Mm-hmm. Is that true? I mean, because that's something that I feel I hear all the time when it comes to people who want to talk about segregation. Like, well, I want to live in a neighborhood with people like me. Is that true? I mean, you have stats on that.
Well, it's interesting because I think that assumes that everyone has an equal level of choice, right? In the places that they live. And what we increasingly know is that that's not the case. There's a study out of UIC here locally. Very interesting. They divided people, white, African-American, Latino, and asked for three things. One, what is the ideal racial makeup of a community that you might live in, a hypothetical community? And then two, what are the, when they actually did look at a place to move, what was the makeup of the place they actually looked in? And then three, what was the makeup of the neighborhood they ended up in when they actually moved? And profound differences across the three races that all three envisioned a pretty diverse neighborhood in the abstract, but in reality, white people looked in much, much whiter neighborhoods and settled in much whiter neighborhoods. People of color looked in much more diverse areas, but settled in areas that were much less diverse than was their ideal. And so the authors speculate, you know, very rational, it's likely that very rational sense of a sense of impediment that stopped people from feeling that they
could
do
that. But
there
was this feel on all parts that people wanted to live in diverse neighborhoods. They wanted to live in places that were somewhat integrated.
Not absolutely everyone, but yes, that there was a high sense that that a diverse neighborhood would be a positive thing. But when the rubber hit the road, very different by race.
How it actually breaks down, right?
Yeah. And so I think it's important just to know that many people in this city and the region are not living where they want to live.
Of course.
Or where they choose to live, but where they can best end up.
I was going to say, isn't that that has to be part of the conversation? It has to be part of what is afforded to people. because that's what we're seeing when we talk about segregation. And you know, sometimes it'll veer to stereotypes, like we talked at the beginning, sort of getting a negative connotation, saying that segregation equals poverty or people living. But that's not necessarily what you're looking at, because there are black middle class neighborhoods.
That's right.
You know, but we see more times than not that there is this affordability issue. That, you know, you just mentioned that some black neighborhoods don't gentrify. The rents are lower and things of that nature. And because of the inequality issue that we've talked about on this program and continue, there aren't just choices for people to say, yeah, I'm going to go live in Wicker Park. You know, it's just not, that's just not, I'm not going to, you know what, I'd love to live in Lincoln Park. That's just not afforded to people.
That's correct. And I think we have a tendency, because it's more comfortable, to want to talk about class, but class is heavily racialized, and we have, you know, a very long history in the city of Chicago. We're at the 100-year anniversary of the Great Migration that began in 1916. And I think we see that 100 years of very deliberate decisions that were made had a very real impact on where people have been able to live over time. And those patterns, the laws may have changed, but the patterns persist.
Is there any evidence that says, and you're just starting this, you're embarking on this study, but is there any evidence that says that an integrated neighborhood or living situation for a city it empowers a city or makes the city more efficient? I mean, I think of other places, New York, L.A., they have segregation issues as well, but you'll see more integrated neighborhoods, especially when in the inner city area. Are there any is there any data that backs the fact up that integration is actually an efficient way to run a city?
Well, there's two things that I'll cite there, and I think it's worth noting that the research that we're doing at the city and the regional level is different and is new. So this is exciting,
sure,
to see. But, you know, what we know in other contexts is that, for instance, on a broader scale, when you look at places where high and low skill labor are not able to converge in workplaces, that economies suffer. And we know that on a broader scale, for instance, at the state level or the country level, that is the case, because the way that work is largely arranged now, you need both high and low skill to converge in one place. But if we have people living far away from those workplaces because of the kinds of segregation we've been discussing, or far from transportation that can take them to those workplaces, then you have a lot of turnover and a lot of churn in those places and unable to maximize. The other piece is that in education, there's a great deal of research that shows that in integrated schools, it is not only lower income students of color that benefit, but that increasingly we see that white and middle class students benefit from being around a diverse environment for the rest of their lives. It impacts their ability to function in college and in the workplace and so on and so forth.
Okay. And then the last thing I just want to mention before we wrap up tonight is the idea that that people of color are the way you say it, is somehow inefficient on their own. They need white people to be whole. That's a myth. I mean, a myth that sort of the idea that, well, integration means that people of color should move to white neighborhoods and that will make everybody more utopian. Talk about that myth and you know, what you guys are doing in the study to sort of deal with that.
Sure. I think this is profound, right? This is gets to the heart of some pushback on the issue of integration, is to say, who's to say that one group of people needs to live around white people in order to somehow function better in the world, right? That's inherently problematic, right? And on a personal note, you know, I lived for over a decade in North Lawndale, just a block north of Little Village. So predominantly African-American, predominantly Mexican-American, respectively. And in that time of living and working there, I never once heard from a neighbor or a coworker someone say, boy, I wish I lived around more white people. You know, what I heard them say was, I wish I could walk to a grocery store. I wish I could send my child outside without fear of violence. I wish that my school was better resourced, right? So achieving those things should not have to equate to living around white people. But because of how closely income is tied to race and how much racism still exists in housing and retail markets, in this country, unfortunately, it usually still does. So one last point on this. I think it's important to distinguish here between race and racism and not commingle the terms. So what I mean by that is there's nothing inherent about race itself, right? There's no magic or deficits with which any certain race has inherently, of course. But there is everything that is, you know, pervasive about racism. And so as long as there's gaps and disparities in wages, in wealth and health, right, and incarceration and all of those areas that are differential by race, as long as there's deep racism in housing markets and so on, then integration does need to be part of the conversation. So it's about racism.
Well, we got to check back in with you as this continues, a two-year study on the cost-neutral idea of segregation. Marisa Navarra is a director at the Metropolitan Planning Council. She's my guest tonight in the How to Improve segment here on The Download. Thanks for coming in, and you got to come back.
Thanks, Justin.